Okay, we will hear from Ms. Jackson representing Mr. Kerma.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Mary Jackson, and I represent Mr. Eric Kerma, the plaintiff appellant in this case. Today we're here to ask this court to overturn the lower court's grant of summary judgment on Mr. Kerma's claims arising out of Louisiana's Final Wage Payment Act and his claims arising out of Louisiana's whistleblower statute. Your Honors, the Final Wage Payment Act is a very simple, straightforward statute. It mandates that an employer must pay its terminated employees on the earlier of the next regular pay date or within 15 days of termination, and it prohibits an employer from requiring.
All right, now what are the consequences if we found that the bonus at issue here was paid on, I believe it's September the 20th, when he was advised that the check was there for him to pick up?
That's not the what happened. What happened is that he went to go pick up his check from the airline highway store, which is his normal practice, on the 15th, and Goodyear's corporate headquarters had sent that bonus check there, and it was waiting for him to pick it up. That was his next regular pay date to pick up the check, and they didn't give him the check then because then they decided they'd overpaid him. So by the time they sent it on the 20th, if in fact they did, it was already too late, not having it on the 15th.
Okay, so what are the consequences of that?
Mr. Kerma is entitled to penalties, the statutory mandated penalties for the delay.
For which is what?
It's going to be, that would be 5 days penalty wages, if indeed it was there on the 20th. But actually, he didn't get that check until October 20th. And so actually, he got it 35 days late.
Why? Tell me again. I'm not quite, you're maybe a little too close to that mic.
I'm sorry.
It has an echo, and so.
Why was the check not available to him? Why wouldn't September the 20th be the date that he would have received the check because it was simply available to him?
No, Your Honor.
I know, but tell me why.
Why? Because no one let him know the check was there. Nobody
told him the check was there.
Correct. It's not the employee's obligation to keep going back randomly to his place of employment to look for a check after he's gone on his next regular pay date and it wasn't there. And it should have been paid on the...
But they did not call him and tell him it's
there. There's no evidence in the record that it was there or that he knew about it. In fact, it was actually found later sitting in his personnel file in Ohio.
Yeah, I thought it was sent back to corporate office, wherever, and then they mailed it to him on the 20th.
Right, they found it in his personnel file along with his demand letter and mailed it to him over a month after he should have gotten it.
They didn't mail it to him until after the demand letter.
Correct. They actually had the demand letter with it in the file, and that's a violation of the statute. The second way Goodyear violated the final wage payment statute is that it required that Mr. Kerma forfeit 3 days' salary upon termination. It doesn't matter that Goodyear's policy is that we pay all of our employees while they're suspended, but we don't pay the terminated ones, but we pay them if they're reinstated. That policy violates the law, and Goodyear cannot rely on an illegal policy to avoid compliance.
Wait a minute. I thought there was I think it's an IRA or IRS reg that basically, or a labor reg that basically says that the last week that an employee works, the employer does not have to pay the employee for the entire week the days that he doesn't work.
Correct. That regulation stands for the proposition that because Mr. Kerma was fired on September 14th, they don't have to pay him through the 15th, which is the end of the pay cycle.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that they don't have to pay him for days that he was technically still employed. And under the Final Wage Payment Act, retroactively terminating him and forfeiting those wages is a black-letter violation. Mr. Kerma is, under this statute, entitled to be paid for those 3 days, and he's also entitled to recover the statutory penalties and attorney's fees because he should have been paid this salary back on September 15, 2010. And the final way that Goodyear violated the Wage Payment Act is that it failed to pay Mr. Kerma his earned vacation pay until over 17 months after he was terminated.
That's not before us, though.
Yes, it is.
The vacation pay is before us?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
I thought the district court didn't rule on that.
No, the district court's decision was a little bit confusing because they held that
this is a 54B certification.
Yes.
Which means that something is still down in the district court.
Right. What happened is that the district court held that The vacation pay had been timely paid because Mr. Kermer didn't demand it until March 12th, and that's an incorrect. That's an incorrect interpretation, and that's an error of law. But then the district court said that we'll save penalties and attorney's fees for the jury, and then proceeded to go ahead and say that it didn't see that there was a bona fide dispute. Yeah. So it's
hold on a minute. What was certified in the 54B certification?
Right now, the certification is that Mr. Kermer didn't demand his vacation pay until March 12th.
That's an issue that's certified here.
That's the issue, yes. That was a finding that the district court made, and that's an incorrect finding of the law.
Finding of law? What was certified here?
The
certification. Isn't there a certification, a 54B certification, that tells you exactly what you can appeal?
Yes.
In that certified order of the court?
Yes, and the district court found that Mr.
Not what it found, but what did it certify?
It certified the issue of whether or not Mr. Kermer demanded his wages before March 12, 2012. That was one of the issues that the trial court found.
His vacation pay?
Yes, his vacation pay, and that's an incorrect. That was an incorrect decision. Because Mr. Kermer demanded that vacation pay back in September 2010, like he demanded all of his other wages. And Goodyear's argument that he had to specifically demand this pay is completely without merit, and it's something that Goodyear's actually made up, because their policy is that they don't pay their terminated employees earned vacation pay. And they either didn't know or didn't care until March 2012, when Mr. Kermer filed his summary judgment, that they did, in fact, owe him those wages. So now they've come back with this fictional requirement that Mr. Kermer had to specifically demand those wages in order for penalties and attorney's fees to attach.
You're suggesting that the law allowed that when he asked for his wages, that means everything, vacation, bonus, and these 4 days.
Absolutely. And the one Louisiana state court that's addressed this was the Louisiana Second Circuit, and they've specifically rejected the precise argument Goodyear sets forth today. That was Robledo v. Oil Motors. And in Robledo, the employer ignored a general demand for damages. And then the employee later came back and made a written specific demand. The employer finally paid after the written specific demand and then tried to claim that they didn't know penalties from the date of the general demand because they hadn't been put on notice of the specific wages claimed. The appellate court rejected that contention and said no. The wages demanded were due and owing on September 15th, and it's undisputed that Mr. Kermer's vacation pay is wages, and they were due and owing, and his general demand for wages is sufficient to start the penalties and attorney's fees.
Ms. Jackson, what is our jurisdiction, our subject matter jurisdiction here?
Subject matter jurisdiction is Mr. Kermer initially had filed several federal complaints.
Okay, so there were some federal,
and the
court kept these state matters?
Yes, the state matters are the ones that are coming to the appellate court. But there's no support in the law for any of Goodyear's propositions under the Final Wage Payment Act, and accordingly, the trial court's decisions based on that act should be overturned. This case should be remanded back to that court for a trial on the merits consistent with the actual interpretation of that statute. And the second issue before the court today is the trial court's grant of summary judgment on Mr. Kermer's claims arising out of the whistleblower statute. While Mr. Kermer was working at Goodyear's Lakeside location, he became aware that mechanics were committing theft from customers. He reported this behavior to Goodyear, and after repeatedly...
What were they doing?
They were performing a service called a drain and fill, which is a lower-priced service. And what they were actually charging customers for is something called a machine coolant flush, which requires a specific machine and a specific type of coolant. When Goodyear actually finally, after Mr. Kermer kept badgering them, saying these mechanics are stealing...
They said they were not... What is your response to their argument that there was no overcharge, that they did change the particular fluid that they were flushing, whatever they were flushing?
That's incorrect. If there were no actual overcharge, then there would have been no reason for Goodyear to actually write the mechanics up for charging customers for services not performed and for not being able to charge a customer the full price if they don't perform the full service.
The reprimand syndicate cannot charge full price if not given full service, cannot charge for service if not completely done.
Yes, there would be no reason to mention charging customers for not performing a full service if there wasn't a discrepancy between the price charged and the actual service and the cost of the service performed. And instead of being grateful that Mr. Kermer reported theft, Goodyear instead, management referred to him as a rat, and it began to retaliate against him for reporting that theft. The district court actually applied the wrong standard when it evaluated this case. And instead of applying the summary judgment standard and reviewing the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. Kirmer, the district court instead found and acknowledged that there were issues of material fact, but then proceeded to weigh the credibility of the witnesses, weigh those facts, interpret witnesses' statements, and disregard relevant facts that were presented before it. When a proper summary judgment standard is applied, it's apparent that there was sufficient evidence from which a reasonable trier of fact could find in favor of Mr. Kirmer, and that genuine issues of material fact exist as to whether or not his termination was based upon the fact that he reported theft and later retaliation against him for reporting theft to Goodyear. One of the key issues is that the day that Goodyear finally wrote up these mechanics after Mr. Kirmer had been after them for months, they immediately transferred him to another store, which was known to be a less lucrative location and where it was impossible for him to make as much money. This was testified to by defendants from Goodyear.
I thought the summary judgment evidence was that store had a lesser standard in order to make bonus, I'll go ahead.
No,
did he protest the movement at the time?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Did he protest the move?
He didn't get a chance to. He was sent home and told to report there the next day, which is highly irregular in and of itself. And the fact that it was...
I didn't get your answer. Did he complain or protest the fact that he was being transferred?
Not at that time, no. He didn't get a chance to. He was sent home, told to go to the next place. The fact that that was known to be a less lucrative location and the temporal connection is in and of itself a question for the jury as to whether that was an adverse employment action. Additionally, for the jury should be the fact that his termination, far from being removed from his report of theft, and then later he reported the theft and retaliation to what was supposed to be an anonymous hotline at Goodyear. Now, Goodyear argues that his termination was completely separate from the retaliation and hotline report. However, this is not the case. The person that he reported as retaliating against him, who knew about it, who found out about it, even though it was supposed to be anonymous because that person was assigned to investigate the veracity of his allegation, that man's name was David Gattuso. And David Gattuso was directly responsible for telling Mr. Kirmer's manager, report him to HR, and then telling HR, fire this person.
Now, was there summary judgment evidence that the transfer from Lakeside to Gentilly did not cause him to lose the bonuses because the lower sales volumes came with lower sales targets, and therefore it was easier to receive the bonuses?
No, Your Honor. The actual summary judgment evidence presented was that it was not only known to be that it was impossible for him to make as much money in tire sales, and that he actually did not make as much money in tire sales.
And that comes from Mr. Kirmer himself.
Mr. Kirmer testified that he did not make as much, but witnesses for Goodyear also say that it would have been impossible for him to make as much in tire sales at that location. Finally, in addition to David Gattuso being responsible for Mr. Kirmer being terminated, the HR person who covered up his hotline report and who specifically targeted him, who told his manager to document him carefully because he'd filed that hotline report, was also directly involved in his termination. Her name was Emily Baranek, and she was also asked what she would do about Mr. Kirmer, and she said terminate him. So the person he reported as previously retaliating against him and a person who covered up that report of retaliation and who targeted him and wanted him documented because of that report were directly responsible for him being terminated.
I thought that there was undisputed evidence that Cronin indicated that she did not rely on Gattuso.
No, the testimony was that on the basis of Gattuso and Ms. Baranek, that Mr. Kirmer was in fact terminated. Like their input was why
he was terminated, but she did not rely on anything from this guy that may have retaliated against him. Gattuso, I guess, is how it's pronounced.
The evidence in the record was that she did. She took their input in on the basis of their input, that she actually did terminate him, and they had input into that decision. So they were both involved. This was no arm's length transaction. And finally, an issue for the jury is the fact that the reason that Goodyear claims that it terminated Mr. Kirmer for sleeping on duty is not an undisputed fact. In fact, the record shows that Mr. Kirmer had clocked out, was on a break, and had taken a nap because he was ill. And that is, in fact, the undisputed testimony in the record is that Goodyear employees are allowed to clock out and take breaks and take naps on their breaks. It's not a terminal offense or even an offense at Goodyear. And when the actual summary judgment standard is applied, It's clear that this case should go back for a trial for a jury on the merits and let the jury decide whether or not Mr. Kermer was terminated in retaliation for reporting theft and then good years later retaliation against him for reporting it. Thank you.
It says well-timed argument, you're right at the end. All right, we will hear from Ms. Emmett representing Goodyear.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Elizabeth Harper Emmett, representing defendant Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. If I could take a few minutes just to sort of do an introduction. First of all, I'd like to address the whistleblower claim first. First of all, Goodyear should prevail. Mr. Kermer has not proven that there was an actual violation of state law. Second, even if this court somehow finds that he has sustained his burden of proof, he has not proven that the various employment actions that he's alleging are A, adverse, and B, were taken as a result of the report. Mr. Kermer started this case out alleging every possible claim.
This is on summary judgment, though. He doesn't necessarily have to prove these claims. All he's got to show is this disputed issue of fact.
Correct. And there is no issue of disputed fact. He's characterized this case as a conspiracy, and the record evidence and the law shows that this conspiracy issue does not fly. Taking his facts as true, he first made the report as to how these two technicians at one store location were performing flushes in September of 2008. He was transferred to the Gentile store over 16 months later. He was transferred to the airline store over 20 months later from that initial report. And finally, he was terminated for violating a company policy. He was sleeping on duty while at work 25 months after that very first report. The termination was two stores removed from where he made that first report. It's undisputed evidence the termination was initiated by the store manager, Rich Riccardi, who had no involvement in that original report, and he testified that he had no knowledge of the report or the hotline call. It was also a different human resources manager, Patricia Cronin, that approved this final termination. So essentially,
now, I presume this guy, how do you pronounce his name? Gattuso?
Gattuso.
He was at the original store.
No, he's the district manager.
Oh,
so he's sort of involved. He's over all the New Orleans area stores. Okay. So essentially what Mr. Kermer is arguing is that an employer can't take any sort of employment action in the course of the workplace if an employee makes an internal complaint. And if you look at 23.967, the definition of reprisal, it addresses this issue. Specifically says nothing in this section shall prohibit an employer from enforcing an established policy, procedure, practice, or exempt an employee from complying with such.
What do you have to say about the fact that there's no evidence that he violated the rule, at least on the second time or the first time, about sleeping on the job?
I think, Your Honor, that you need to look at the record evidence. I think it speaks for itself. There are multiple witness statements, and I think it's important to note that these witnesses are not managerial employees or not human resources folks. They were employees that were actually under Mr. Kermer. So what retaliatory motive would they have? There were multiple witness statements. If you look at the record, it doesn't show that he was clocked out. It, in fact, shows he didn't clock out till 4:11. The witness statements obviously are, you know, written by people. They, you know, they say what they say about the different times, but generally they are all pretty clear that he was asleep before he clocked out.
But Kermer says that he wasn't. I mean, doesn't that create a material issue effect on whether or not he was sleeping or not? Just that testimony. I mean, on the summary judgment. Now, you're probably correct on that this is pretty strong evidence to a jury, perhaps. But at this stage, is that sufficient? Or are you saying that because the documents indicate otherwise, that you can't accept his testimony?
I mean, the burden of proof in a summary judgment is obviously the plaintiff has to make his prima facie case, and then the employer can present a non-discriminatory, legitimate reason for why they took the action. In this case, it was that the employer had a good faith basis based on the investigation that, in fact, there had been a violation.
But if he testifies that he wasn't asleep, then the reason that you've given that he was asleep is at issue. It is an issue of whether you were telling the truth at the third stage of the McDonnell-Douglas test.
Well, the third stage is obviously, can he show pretext? And it's a but-for standard. Can he show that but for the report, he would not have been terminated?
I thought that the second stage, whether the employer actually had good grounds or not, is that if there was some evidence that they did and they said they acted on it, whether you don't go behind whether that was a valid reason.
That's correct.
But see, my point is just simply this. Once you submit a reason, and you have, he was sleeping, the bubble bursts, and then there has to be some evidence that you are not. One aspect is that they can have, direct evidence. But the other thing is that the company was lying in giving this pretext, official reason for his termination. And hasn't he shown by his own testimony that your reason, or the reason that was given, and it's only a matter of production, nothing else, but that indicates, or that puts it in a position where there is a question of fact that defeats the summary judgment?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the case law...
He has to come forward with evidence that will rebut the evidence that the employer has given that there were other grounds to terminate him. And as Judge Garza's pointed out, the question is whether all of these other witnesses that apparently have testified and the employer's relying upon those witnesses can also at the same time result in a trial over on basis on his statement that he was not sleeping. I mean, that's...
I don't think that that's not
well,
the analysis.
I mean, say, he has not overcome, he may well not have overcome his burden of showing that the assertion that you have given for his termination was pretext.
Correct. I mean, our burden is just to show there's a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, and we presented it. There was a code of conduct. It says immediate termination if someone is sleeping on duty.
That's not the question. The question is it undisputed, no question of fact, that he was or was not sleeping? I mean, that he says he wasn't sleeping on the job.
But that's not the analysis at the summary judgment stage or at this stage.
Well, he has created a question of fact on that, hasn't he?
Not on this analysis.
No.
I'm not gonna press this, but it just seems to me that
under the general summary judgment burden, I think Judge Garza is correct. That is a disputed issue of fact, but the burden is on him to come forward with more than just a disputed issue of fact. He's got to show. The burden is on him to show that the reasons that you gave for his termination is a pretext.
Right, yeah. And that it's but for that report.
And it's retaliation.
It's retaliation.
But we don't have the pretext plus anymore.
You do on retaliation. It's.
Is it on retaliation that you still have that?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's still the but for. It's the but for standard. And I think that that's really important. Okay, if I could go on to address, first of all, he's got to prove that there was an actual violation of state.
What do you say about whether this business of the vacation pay is before us?
Your Honor, it is certainly our position, and I don't think that we were very clear in our brief, and I do apologize for that. But yes, it is certainly our position that this whole vacation penalty issue And let me just be clear, we've paid the vacation, so all we're dealing with is a penalty issue. And that, yes, Judge Berrigan said that that was an issue for the jury, and she deferred that to the jury. And so that wasn't a final decision. So that has not been certified for appeal. That is not before this court.
So that's, I mean, you're conceding that trial has got to be held on that issue.
We are. We are. It's not before this court. Going back to the state law issue, he hasn't proved it. He's only identified one law that Goodyear has allegedly violated, the theft. And you look at 14-1467. And what he's claiming is that two technicians at one particular Goodyear location were charging a customer for a coolant flush, that's about a $40 unit value, and actually performing the less expensive service of a drain and fill, and that is theft. First of all, a drain and fill is you drain the coolant, you fill it up with new coolant. It's a cheaper service. A flush, that is when you drain the old coolant, you run the water chemical through it, and then you fill it up with new. It can be done manually. It can be done with a machine. There is no difference in the result, and the price is the same. And I would like that your honors to look at, there's an invoice in the record that actually Mr. Kermer went to a store and asked for prices on a drain and fill and also a flush. Look
and what at does it. What does the reprimand, the official reprimand, says cannot charge full price if not given full service, cannot charge for service if not completely done?
Okay. First of all, you look at it. The first one says behavior, doing manual flush on coolant. Doesn't mention that they were doing a drain and fill. And it does go on.
It seems to me that's not the evidence. You have to comment on why the cannot charge full price, you know, is raises a question of fact of what they did in this particular action.
Your Honor, I think you have to read the whole document in of its entirety. And you also have to understand this was not written by an HR person or by some high-level executive. It was written by a store manager. I'd also like to make
it's an official.
If he reads the whole document, how's that going to change his mind now?
Well, because it says not using flush machine. It doesn't say performing a drain and fill when charging for a coolant.
Okay. It says full flush. Cannot charge full price. That indicates that something was overcharged.
I think you have to read the whole thing in its entirety.
Okay.
I'd also like to make the point that they are calling this an employee disciplinary action. This is a performance improvement plan. There is no record evidence that this is some sort of disciplinary action. In fact,
I thought that it was called a reprimand.
It's called a performance improvement plan.
Okay.
And I also want you to look at the code of conduct, which is in the record. If the employees, if the investigation had revealed that the employees had, in fact, committed theft, right above sleeping on duty, it's an immediate termination. And I will give you that if those two employees were immediately terminated for theft, that would be the evidence that you need to show that there was an actual violation of state
law.
Well,
that's assuming they comply with their own regulations. I mean, that's the allegation here, that they're not complying with their own regulations.
Well, I also want to make the point that to prove theft, there was no report to the police. There was no criminal investigation. All he has is his subjective belief that it was a drain and fill versus a flush and these two performance improvement plans. Where's the customer? Where's the customer's name? Where's the date that this happened? Where's the vehicle make and model that this happened? If you look at that theft statute, the punishment is based on the dollar amount at issue. Well, here, we can't even say, oh, yes, there was theft, and this would be what the punishment would be, because we don't know the dollar amount at issue. Did it happen once? Did it happen over and over and
That's
over
a
again?
Great, it's a great jury argument. I don't know if it works at summary judgment.
But my point is, it's his burden of proof, and all he has is two performance improvement plans.
Excuse me, it's your burden on the summary judgment.
No, it's his, under the whistleblower statute, it is his burden of proof to show that that Goodyear committed a state law violation. And, Your Honors, even if you do find that Goodyear, these two technicians, committed a state law violation and it was theft, you then go to, well, has Kermer proved that he was retaliated against for reporting the theft, which he acknowledges he started reporting as early as September of 2008. And let me just walk you through what he's alleging. First of all, he's alleging a transfer. Okay. Record evidence is very clear. The transfers happen all the time at Goodyear. This isn't a lawyer who happens to work the New Orleans office. This is a Goodyear.
What's the evidence about the pay?
The pay.
Opportunity to earn the same bonus.
He was still a service manager. He was still making the same base pay. The bonus issue is, I believe Judge Garza was the one asking about this, that yes, the bonus is, it's not based on just how many tires you just happen to sell. It's based on the numbers. It's obviously based on the size of the store. And those numbers or the goals are set at the beginning of every year.
If so the goal is less, then the bonus are easier to get.
Correct.
And that's a...
Correct.
Was there testimony from Goodyear people that there's no way he could have made as much money after his transfer?
No. And in fact, what I think is also important to note is that there's no evidence by Mr. Kermer, other than his own subjective belief that he would have made more, is there's no comparison between the same time he was at Gentilly and the bonuses he made at Gentilly, and then if he had been at the Lakeside store at that time and what the bonus would have been. There's no record evidence of that, and that's the comparison. It's the same timing. But it's also, like Judge Garza is focusing on, the targets are different. I mean, you can't compare. You can't just say one's a bigger
volume. That's what the evidence is. We understand the point. Just what is the evidence?
The evidence is all strictly based on his own subjective belief. That there's no evidence that he, as far as I know, that there's no evidence that he would have necessarily made more at the Lakeside store. And in fact, it's a very common practice for all of these employees to be shoveled around from store to store. And if you look, we have a document that shows all the different transfers. And, you know, I think in 2010, 27 employees were transferred, 11 were service managers. And again, he's got to show that he was transferred because of the report. He's first started making the report in September of 08. So under his logic, well, he should have been transferred as soon as he started making these reports.
Well, let me ask, did he complain at that time?
Yes. He complained. He says the record is that he complained to his store manager.
That he was being transferred?
Oh, no. He did not. He never complained to his store manager about that.
All right. When is the first time that he raised the transfer as discrimination?
I believe he first alleged that when he made the hotline call, which was in April. And that was also the same day he claims that
which was April, but, I mean, when did the incident occur?
When did the transfer occur?
When did the transfer?
Transfer occurred in January.
January.
Mm-hmm. I also want to point out that although yes, there is some evidence that perhaps Mr. Kermer may have made a report in January to Mr. Gattuso, there is record evidence, and I would refer you to Dave Gattuso's deposition testimony, that the transfers had been in the works for 30 to 60 days before it actually took place. And although there's an email that between Lubin Lane and Gattuso about the transfer, all that is, and the record is clear on this, that was just an email saying, okay, this is when we're going to do it. But it had certainly been in the works for a long time.
What about the timing of the bonus after severance?
I'm sorry, what?
The timing, he says you didn't pay the bonus timely after he was terminated.
Okay. Let me just bear with me a second, because first of all, this is an entirely new sort of facts that he's bringing up. If you look at Judge Berrigan's order, originally at the summary judgment level, the argument was that we erred because we didn't mail the bonus. And Judge Berrigan rightly held that the statute requires that payment may be made at the place and manner that's customary during employment, and that the bonus was always at the store. It was not direct deposited. It was never mailed. It was just at the store. Well, now he's coming in and saying, oh, well, no, the 15th of the month was always a regularly scheduled payday for bonus. as you know, bonus is a different payment than the regular paycheck. And if we had known that this fact was going to be there, we certainly would have had record evidence that there was no 15th regular payday for a bonus.
You need to complete your argument. You're about to run out of time.
Okay. If you look at what he is citing, all he is saying is that he went to the store on the 15th for the bonus. He's not saying, there's no evidence that the bonus is regularly paid on the 15th. And what happened was the paycheck was cut prior to his termination. It was an overpayment. So technically, he actually received a portion of his bonus on the 15th. It was the overpayment of the paycheck. They realized when the bonus check did arrive, the store manager quickly realized that it was the wrong amount because of the overpayment. They sent it back to Ohio on the 20th, and I would refer you to Tricia Cronin's declaration. She does a nice job of outlining the events of this. The check was not in Ohio. It was sent back to the store. It sat in the store for a long time. If you look, Mr. Kermer's lawyer wrote a demand letter on September the 30th. When that was sent up to HR, they asked for the personnel file from the store in New Orleans. It was sent to Ohio. That's when they realized the check was still sitting there.
Okay, well, you have
thank you.
Made your points clear, and you've not waived any arguments that you made in the brief. So, Ms. Jackson?
Briefly, Your Honors. To address Ms. Emmett's statement that we didn't raise the issue and the facts about the bonus check being there on the next regular payday, this issue was addressed in our reply briefs below, and it was we cited to the record where the facts are actually in the record, and I've outlined those in my brief, and I don't want to bore you with going back through the actual citations, but that was evidence in the record, and you just didn't address it. The bonus check was sent to Mr. Kermer to be paid on the 15th. Goodyear decided not to give it to him on the 15th for their own internal reasons. That also violated the Wage Payment Act, and that's a violation of the law. He was entitled to be paid his bonus check, and an employer has to pay, even if they dispute the amount owed to the employee, they have to pay the undisputed portion of the wages owed on the next regular payday. In this case, Goodyear failed to do that, and that's a violation of the law. In addition, I want to address some of the issues that you raised with respect to the retaliation issue. First, on the issue of whether or not Mr. Kermer's transfer was routine and had been in the works for months, no. On the very same day that Lumen Lane wrote up these employees, finally, after being badgered by Mr. Kermer, these people are stealing for months, he emailed David Gattuso, requested his transfer, and Mr. Kermer was immediately transferred to a place where it was known that it was going to be less lucrative. Goodyear's employees said that at this location and this store, it was impossible for Mr. Kermer to actually make as much in sales. And I can give you the sites. It's at USCA 5, 1866, 67, 1911, 13, 1954, 1956, 1994 to 96, and then USCA 6, 21, 14 to 15. This is evidence in the record. So the same day that they finally wrote up mechanics for stealing, Mr. Kermer got transferred to a less lucrative location. Another issue that I want to raise is that, as you were asking about, the fact that whether or not a crime is even committed is actually an issue of fact that should go to the jury, because when we're actually sitting here trying to interpret these documents and interpret the write-ups, that's something that should be put in front of the jury, not for the court to decide on summary judgment. In addition, I know that there was an issue with the but-for standard, and you say that Mr. Kermer should have to prove that but for the retaliation, he wouldn't have been terminated. In this case, but for the retaliation, we don't think he would have even been reported for sleeping. And had he been reported for sleeping, someone would have actually gone and done an investigation. What happened here is that employees told Mr. Riccardi, we saw Mr. Kermer sleeping. Mr. Riccardi then immediately called David Gattuso. David Gattuso told Mr. Riccardi, report that guy to HR. David Gattuso told HR, report that guy. David Gattuso told HR, terminate Mr. Kermer. At no point did anybody conduct any investigation into whether Mr. Kermer was sleeping. The witness statements that opposing counsel referred to were prepared well after the fact. They're all inconsistent. Nobody at Goodyear has any idea which one's correct, if any of them are correct. No one even asked Mr. Kermer, did you clock out, much less bother to check his time records. What happened here is that they wanted to get rid of this man. He reported theft. Management called him a rat. It was known throughout the company that management thought of him as a rat. And at the first opportunity that Goodyear thought they could get rid of Mr. Kermer, the people he reported for retaliating against him, the people who were involved in covering up that report of retaliation and who targeted him because he filed a report saying he was being retaliated against, immediately recommended he be terminated without even bothering to look to see if what he'd done was a terminable offense. And it wasn't. Clocking out, the act of clocking out and taking a break and sleeping was testified in this undisputed testimony in the record. Goodyear employees are allowed to do this. These issues, as well as the other issues of fact in this case, mean that this case should go to a jury. Maybe a jury would look at all of this and find that Mr. Kermer was retaliated against. Maybe it wouldn't. But it's not for the court on summary judgment to usurp that role. When we're getting into disputing witness statements, we're getting into interpreting documents, we're getting into looking at motivation and what a witness meant when they said that they were targeting Mr. Kermer and what another witness meant when they said that he should be documented heavily for filing a report, this is all stuff that should be left for a jury, not the court to just dismiss this case on summary judgment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.